In the morning he put on his best clothes, which were poor enough, and began stirring about, putting some bread and meat into a page of a newspaper. Carrie watched him, interested in this new move. "Where are you going?" she asked. "Over to Brooklyn," he answered. Then, seeing her still inquisitive, he added, "I think I can get on over there." "On the trolley lines?" said Carrie, astonished. "Yes," he rejoined. "Aren't you afraid?" she asked. "What of?" he answered. "The police are protecting them."
"The paper said 4 men were hurt yesterday."
"Yes," he returned, "but you can't go by what the papers say. They'll run the cars all right." He looked rather determined now, in a desolate sort of way, and Carrie felt very sorry. Something of the old Hurstwood was here, the least shadow of what was once shrewd and pleasant strength. Outside it was cloudy and blowing a few flakes of snow. "What a day to go over there," thought Carrie. Now he left before she did, which was a remarkable thing, and tramped eastward to 14th Street and 6th Avenue, where he took the car. He had read that scores of applicants were applying at the office of the Brooklyn City Railroad Building and were being received. He made his way there by horse car and ferry, a dark, silent man, to the offices in question. It was a long way, for no cars were running, and the day was cold, but he trudged along grimly. Once in Brooklyn, he could clearly see and feel that a strike was on. People showed it in their manner. Along the routes of certain tracks, not a car was running. About certain corners and nearby saloons, small groups of men were lounging. Several spring wagons passed him, equipped with plain wooden chairs and labeled Flatbush or Prospect Park, fare 10 cents. He noticed cold and even gloomy faces. Labor was having its little war. When he came near the office in question, he saw a few men standing about and some policemen. On the far corners were other men, whom he took to be strikers, watching. All the houses were small and wooden, the streets poorly paved. After New York, Brooklyn looked actually poor and hard up. He made his way into the heart of the small group, eyed by policemen and the men already there. One of the officers addressed him. "What are you looking for?" "I want to see if I can get a place." "The offices are up those steps," said the blue coat. His face was a very neutral thing to contemplate. In his heart of hearts, he sympathized with the strikers and hated this scab. In his heart of hearts also, he felt the dignity and use of the police force, which commanded order. Of its true social significance he never once dreamed. He was not the mind for that. The two feelings blended in him, neutralized one another and him. He would have fought for this man as determinedly as for himself, and yet only so far as commanded. Strip him of his uniform, and he would have soon picked his side. Hurstwood ascended a dusty flight of steps and entered a small dust-colored office, in which were a railing, a long desk, and several clerks. "Well, sir," said a middle-aged man, looking up at him from the long desk. "Do you want to hire any men?" inquired Hurstwood. "What are you, a motorman?" "No, I'm not anything," said Hurstwood. He was not at all abashed by his position. He knew these people needed men. If one didn't take him, another would. This man could take him or leave him just as he chose. "Well, we prefer experienced men, of course," said the man. He paused while Hurstwood smiled indifferently. Then he added, "Still, I guess you can learn. What is your name?"
"Wheeler," said Hurstwood. The man wrote an order on a small card.
"Take that to our barns," he said, "and give it to the foreman. He'll show you what to do." Hurstwood went down and out. He walked straight away in the direction indicated, while the policeman looked after.
"There's another once to try it," said Officer Keeley to Officer Macy.
"I have my mind he'll get his fill," returned the latter quietly. They had been in strikes before.
XLI. The Strike.
The barn at which Hurstwood applied was exceedingly short-handed and was being operated practically by three men as directors. There were a lot of green hands around, queer, hungry-looking men who looked as if want had driven them to desperate means. They tried to be lively and willing, but there was an air of hangdog diffidence about the place. Hurstwood went back through the barns and out into a large enclosed lot, where were a series of tracks and loops. A half-dozen cars were there, manned by instructors, each with a pupil at the lever. More pupils were waiting at one of the rear doors of the barn. In silence, Hurstwood viewed this scene and waited. His companions took his eye for a while, though they did not interest him much more than the cars. They were an uncomfortable-looking gang, however. One or two were very thin and lean. Several were quite stout. Several others were raw-boned and sallow, as if they had been beaten upon by all sorts of rough weather. "Did you see by the paper they are going to call out the militia?" Hurstwood heard one of them remark. "Oh, they'll do that," returned the other. "They always do." "Think we're liable to have much trouble?" said another, whom Hurstwood did not see. "Not very." "That Scotchman that went out on the last car," put in a voice, "told me that they hit him in the ear with a cinder." A small nervous laugh accompanied this. "One of those fellows on the Fifth Avenue line must have had a hell of a time, according to the papers," drawled another. "They broke his car windows and pulled him off into the street before the police could stop him." "Yes, but there are more police around today," was added by another. Hurstwood hearkened without much mental comment. These talkers seemed scared to him. Their gabbling was feverish, things said to quiet their own minds. He looked out into the yard and waited. Two of the men got around quite near to him, but behind his back. They were rather social, and he listened to what they said. "Are you a railroad man?" said one. "Me? No. I've always worked in a paper factory." "I had a job in Newark until last October," returned the other with reciprocal feeling. There were some words that passed too low to hear. Then the conversation became strong again. "I don't blame these fellers for striking," said one. "They've got the right of it, all right, but I had to get something to do." "Same here," said the other. "If I had any job in Newark, I wouldn't be over here taking chances like these." "It's hell these days, ain't it?" said the man. "A poor man ain't nowhere. You could starve, by God, right in the streets, and there ain't most no one would help you." "Right you are," said the other. "The job I had I lost 'cause they shut down. They run all summer and lay up a big stock and then shut down." Hurstwood paid some little attention to this. Somehow he felt a little superior to these two, a little better off. To him, these were ignorant and commonplace, poor sheep in a driver's hand. "Poor devils," he thought, speaking out of the thoughts and feelings of a bygone period of success. "Next," said one of the instructors. "You're next," said a neighbor, touching him. He went out and climbed on the platform. The instructor took it for granted that no preliminaries were needed. "You see this handle," he said, reaching up to an electric cutoff which was fastened to the roof. "This throws the current off or on. If you want to reverse the car, you turn it over here. If you want to send it forward, you put it over here. If you want to cut off the power, you keep it in the middle." Hurstwood smiled at the simple information. "Now, this handle here regulates your speed. To here," he said, pointing with his finger, "gives you about 4 miles an hour. This is 8. When it's full on, you make about 14 miles an hour." Hurstwood watched him calmly. He had seen motormen work before. He knew just about how they did it, and was sure he could do as well with very little practice. The instructor explained a few more details and then said, "Now we'll back her up." Hurstwood stood placidly by while the car rolled back into the yard. "One thing you want to be careful about, and that is to start easy. Give 1 degree time to act before you start another. The one fault of most men is that they always want to throw her wide open. That's bad. It's dangerous, too. Wears out the motor. You don't want to do that."
I see, said Hurstwood. He waited and waited while the man talked on. Now you take it, he said finally. The ex-manager laid hand to the lever and pushed it, gently, as he thought. It worked much easier than he imagined, however, with the result that the car jerked quickly forward, throwing him back against the door. He straightened up sheepishly while the instructor stopped the car with the brake. You want to be careful about that, was all he said. Hurstwood found, however, that handling a brake and regulating speed were not so instantly mastered as he had imagined. Once or twice he would have plowed through the rear fence if it had not been for the hand and word of his companion. The latter was rather patient with him, but he never smiled. You gotta get the knack of working both arms at once, he said. It takes a little practice. 1 o'clock came while he was still on the car practicing, and he began to feel hungry. The day set in snowing, and he was cold. He grew weary of running to and fro on the short track. They ran the car to the end, and both got off. Hurstwood went into the barn and sought a car step, pulling out his paper-wrapped lunch from his pocket. There was no water and the bread was dry, but he enjoyed it. There was no ceremony about dining. He swallowed and looked about, contemplating the dull, homely labor of the thing. It was disagreeable, miserably disagreeable in all its phases, not because it was bitter, but because it was hard. It would be hard to anyone, he thought. After eating, he stood about as before, waiting until his turn came. The intention was to give him an afternoon of practice, but the greater part of the time was spent in waiting about. At last evening came, and with it hunger and a debate with himself as to how he should spend the night. It was 5:30. He must soon eat. If he tried to go home, it would take him 2 hours and a half of cold walking and riding. Besides, he had orders to report at 7 the next morning, and going home would necessitate his rising at an unholy and disagreeable hour. He had only something like $1.15 of Carrie's money, with which he had intended to pay the 2 weeks' coal bill before the present idea struck him. They must have some place around here, he thought. Where does that fellow from Newark stay? Finally, he decided to ask. There was a young fellow standing near one of the doors in the cold, waiting a last turn. He was a mere boy in years, 21 about, but with a body lank and long because of privation. A little good living would have made this youth plump and swaggering. "How do they arrange this, if a man hasn't any money?" inquired Hurstwood discreetly. The fellow turned a keen, watchful eye on the inquirer. "You mean eat?" he replied. Yes, and sleep. I can't go back to New York tonight. The foreman'll fix that if you ask him, I guess. He did me. That's so. Yes, I just told him I didn't have anything. Gee, I couldn't go home. I live way over in Hoboken. Hurstwood only cleared his throat by way of acknowledgement. They've got a place upstairs here, I understand. I don't know what sort of a thing it is. Pretty tough, I guess. He gave me a meal ticket this noon. I know that wasn't much. Hurstwood smiled grimly, and the boy laughed. It ain't no fun, is it? He inquired, wishing vainly for a cheery reply. Not much, answered Hurstwood. I tackle him now, volunteered the youth. He may go away. Hurstwood did so. Isn't there some place I can stay around here tonight? He inquired. If I have to go back to New York, I'm afraid I won't. "There's some cots upstairs," interrupted the man, "if you want one of them." "That'll do," he assented. He meant to ask for a meal ticket, but the seemingly proper moment never came, and he decided to pay himself that evening. "I'll ask him in the morning." He ate in a cheap restaurant in the vicinity, and being cold and lonely, went straight off to seek the loft in question. The company was not attempting to run cars after nightfall. It was so advised by the police. The room seemed to have been a lounging place for night workers. There were some 9 cots in the place, 2 or 3 wooden chairs, a soap box, and a small round-bellied stove in which a fire was blazing. Early as he was, another man was there before him. The latter was sitting beside the stove, warming his hands.
Hurstwood approached and held out his own toward the fire. He was sick of the bareness and privation of all things connected with his venture, but was steeling himself to hold out. He fancied he could for a while.
"Cold, isn't it?" said the early guest.
"Rather."
A long silence.
"Not much of a place to sleep, is it?" said the man.
"Better than nothing," replied Hurstwood.
Another silence.
"I believe I'll turn in," said the man.
Rising, he went to one of the cots and stretched himself, removing only his shoes and pulling the one blanket and dirty old comforter over him in a sort of bundle. The sight disgusted Hurstwood, but he did not dwell on it, choosing to gaze into the stove and think of something else. Presently, he decided to retire and picked a cot, also removing his shoes. While he was doing so, the youth who had advised him to come here entered, and seeing Hurstwood, tried to be genial.
"Better than nothing," he observed, looking around.
Hurstwood did not take this to himself. He thought it to be an expression of individual satisfaction, and so did not answer. The youth imagined he was out of sorts and set to whistling softly. Seeing another man asleep, he quit that and lapsed into silence. Hurstwood made the best of a bad lot by keeping on his clothes and pushing away the dirty covering from his head, but at last he dozed in sheer weariness. The covering became more and more comfortable, its character was forgotten, and he pulled it about his neck and slept. In the morning he was roused out of a pleasant dream by several men stirring about in the cold, cheerless room. He had been back in Chicago in fancy, in his own comfortable home. Jessica had been arranging to go somewhere, and he had been talking with her about it. This was so clear in his mind that he was startled now by the contrast of this room. He raised his head, and the cold, bitter reality jarred him into wakefulness.
"Guess I'd better get up," he said.
There was no water on this floor. He put on his shoes in the cold and stood up, shaking himself in his stiffness. His clothes felt disagreeable, his hair bad.
"Hell," he muttered as he put on his hat.
Downstairs, things were stirring again. He found a hydrant with a trough which had once been used for horses, but there was no towel here and his handkerchief was soiled from yesterday. He contented himself with wetting his eyes with the ice-cold water, then sought the foreman, who was already on the ground.
"Had your breakfast yet?" inquired that worthy.
"No," said Hurstwood.
"Better get it, then. Your car won't be ready for a little while."
Hurstwood hesitated.
"Could you let me have a meal ticket?" he asked with an effort.
"Here you are," said the man, handing him one. He breakfasted as poorly as the night before on some fried steak and bad coffee. Then he went back.
"Here," said the foreman, motioning him when he came in. "You take this car out in a few minutes."
Hurstwood climbed up on the platform in the gloomy barn and waited for a signal. He was nervous, and yet the thing was a relief. Anything was better than the barn. On this, the fourth day of the strike, the situation had taken a turn for the worse. The strikers, following the counsel of their leaders and the newspapers, had struggled peaceably enough. There had been no great violence done. Cars had been stopped, it is true, and the men argued with. Some crews had been won over and led away. Some windows broken, some jeering and yelling done. But in no more than 5 or 6 instances had men been seriously injured. These by crowds whose acts the leaders disclaimed. Idleness, however, and the sight of the company backed by the police triumphing angered the men. They saw that each day more cars were going on. Each day more declarations were being made by the company officials that the effective opposition of the strikers was broken. This put desperate thoughts in the minds of the men. Peaceful methods meant, they saw, that the companies would soon run all their cars and those who had complained would be forgotten. There was nothing so helpful to the companies as peaceful methods. All at once they blazed forth, and for a week there was storm and stress. Cars were assailed, men attacked, policemen struggled with,
tracks torn up and shots fired, until at last street fights and mob movements became frequent and the city was invested with militia. Hurstwood knew nothing of the change of temper. "Run your car out," called the foreman, waving a vigorous hand at him. A green conductor jumped up behind and rang the bell twice as a signal to start. Hurstwood turned the lever and ran the car out through the door into the street in front of the barn. Here, two brawny policemen got up beside him on the platform, one on either hand. At the sound of a gong near the barn door, two bells were given by the conductor, and Hurstwood opened his lever. The two policemen looked about them calmly.
"'Tis cold all right this morning," said the one on the left, who possessed a rich brogue.
"I had enough of it yesterday," said the other. "I wouldn't want a steady job of this."
"Nor I."
Neither paid the slightest attention to Hurstwood, who stood facing the cold wind, which was chilling him completely, and thinking of his orders.
"Keep a steady gait," the foreman had said. "Don't stop for anyone who doesn't look like a real passenger. Whatever you do, don't stop for a crowd."
The two officers kept silent for a few moments.
"The last man must have gone through all right," said the officer on the left. "I don't see his car anywhere."
"Who's on there?" asked the second officer, referring, of course, to its complement of policemen.
"Schaefer and Ryan."
There was another silence, in which the car ran smoothly along. There were not so many houses along this part of the way. Hurstwood did not see many people, either. The situation was not wholly disagreeable to him. If he were not so cold, he thought he would do well enough. He was brought out of this feeling by the sudden appearance of a curve ahead, which he had not expected. He shut off the current and did an energetic turn at the brake, but not in time to avoid an unnaturally quick turn. It shook him up and made him feel like making some apologetic remarks, but he refrained.
"Want to look out for them things," said the officer on the left, condescendingly.
"That's right," agreed Hurstwood, shamefacedly.
"There's lots of them on this line," said the officer on the right.
Around the corner, a more populated way appeared. One or two pedestrians were in view ahead. A boy coming out of a gate with a tin milk bucket gave Hurstwood his first objectionable greeting.
"Scab!" he yelled. "Scab!"
Hurstwood heard it, but tried to make no comment, even to himself. He knew he would get that, and much more of the same, probably. At a corner farther up, a man stood by the track and signaled the car to stop.
"Never mind him," said one of the officers. "He's up to some game."
Hurstwood obeyed. At the corner, he saw the wisdom of it. No sooner did the man perceive the intention to ignore him than he shook his fist.
"Ah, you bloody coward," he yelled.
Some half-dozen men standing on the corner flung taunts and jeers after the speeding car. Hurstwood winced the least bit. The real thing was slightly worse than the thoughts of it had been. Now came in sight, three or four blocks farther on, a heap of something on the track.
"I've been at work here, all right," said one of the policemen.
"We'll have an argument, maybe," said the other.
Hurstwood ran the car close and stopped. He had not done so wholly, however, before a crowd gathered about. It was composed of ex-motormen and conductors in part, with a sprinkling of friends and sympathizers.
"Come off the car, partner," said one of the men in a voice meant to be conciliatory. "You don't want to take the bread out of another man's mouth, do you?"
Hurstwood held to his brake and lever, pale and very uncertain what to do.
"Stand back," yelled one of the officers, leaning over the platform railing. "Clear out of this now. Give the man a chance to do his work."
"Listen, partner," said the leader, ignoring the policeman and addressing Hurstwood. "We're all working men like yourself. If you were a regular motorman and had been treated as we've been, you wouldn't want anyone to come in and take your place, would you? You wouldn't want anyone to do you out of your chance to get your rights, would you?"
"Shut her off, shut her off," urged the other of the policemen roughly. "Get out of this now."
And he jumped the railing and landed before the crowd and began shoving. Instantly, the other officer was down beside him.
"Stand back now," they yelled. "Get out of this. What the hell do you mean? Out now."
It was like a small swarm of bees.
Don't shove me, said one of the strikers determinedly. I'm not doing anything.
Get out of this, cried the officer, swinging his club. I'll give ye bat on the sconce. Back now.
What the hell? Cried another of the strikers, pushing the other way, addling at the same time some lusty oaths.
Crack came an officer's club on his forehead. He blinked his eyes blindly a few times, wabbled on his legs, threw up his hands, and staggered back. In return, a swift fist landed on the officer's neck. Infuriated by this, the latter plunged left and right, laying about madly with his club. He was ably assisted by his brother of the blue, who poured ponderous oaths upon the troubled waters. No severe damage was done, owing to the agility of the strikers in keeping out of reach. They stood about the sidewalk now and jeered.
"Where is the conductor?" yelled one of the officers, getting his eye on that individual who had come nervously forward to stand by Hurstwood. The latter had stood gazing upon the scene with more astonishment than fear.
"Why don't you come down here and get these stones off the track?" inquired the officer. "What are you standing there for? Do you want to stay here all day? Get down!"
Hurstwood breathed heavily in excitement and jumped down with the nervous conductor as if he had been called.
"Hurry up now," said the other policeman.
Cold as it was, these officers were hot and mad. Hurstwood worked with the conductor, lifting stone after stone and warming himself by the work.
"Ah, you scab, you!" yelled the crowd. "You coward! Steal a man's job, will you? Rob the poor, will you, you thief? We'll get you yet now. Wait!"
Not all of this was delivered by one man. It came from here and there, incorporated with much more of the same sort and curses.
"Work, you blackguards!" yelled a voice. "Do the dirty work! You're the suckers that keep the poor people down!"
"May God starve ye yet!"
yelled an old Irish woman, who now threw open a nearby window and stuck out her head.
"Yes, and you!" she added, catching the eye of one of the policemen. "You bloody murdering thief! Crack my son over the head, will you, you hard-hearted murdering divil? Ah, ye—"
But the officer turned a deaf ear. "Go to the devil, you old hag," he half-muttered as he stared round upon the scattered company. Now the stones were off, and Hurstwood took his place again amid a continued chorus of epithets. Both officers got up beside him, and the conductor rang the bell when, bang, bang, through window and door came rocks and stones. One narrowly grazed Hurstwood's head. Another shattered the window behind.
"Throw open your lever!" yelled one of the officers, grabbing at the handle himself.
Hurstwood complied, and the car shot away, followed by a rattle of stones and a rain of curses.
"That blank, 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 blank hit me in the neck," said one of the officers. "I gave him a good crack for it, though."
"I think I must have left spots on some of them," said the other.
"I know that big guy that called us a blank, 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 blank," said the first. "I'll get him yet for that."
"I thought we were in it for sure once there," said the second. Hurstwood, warmed and excited, gazed steadily ahead. It was an astonishing experience for him. He had read of these things, but the reality seemed something altogether new. He was no coward in spirit. The fact that he had suffered this much now rather operated to arouse a solid determination to stick it out. He did not recur in thought to New York or the flat. This one trip seemed a consuming thing. They now ran into the business heart of Brooklyn uninterrupted. People gazed at the broken windows of the car and at Hurstwood in his plain clothes. Voices called "scab" now and then, as well as other epithets, but no crowd attacked the car. At the downtown end of the line, one of the officers went to call up his station and report the trouble.
"There's a gang out there," he said, "laying for us yet. Better send someone over there and clean them out."
The car ran back more quietly, hooted, watched, flung at, but not attacked. Hurstwood breathed freely when he saw the barns.
"Well," he observed to himself, "I came out of that all right."
The car was turned in, and he was allowed to loaf off a while, but later he was called again. This time a new team of officers was aboard. Slightly more confident, he sped the car along the commonplace streets and felt somewhat less fearful.
On one side, however, he suffered intensely. The day was raw, with a sprinkling of snow and a gusty wind, made all the more intolerable by the speed of the car. His clothing was not intended for this sort of work. He shivered, stamped his feet, and beat his arms as he had seen other motormen do in the past, but said nothing. The novelty and danger of the situation modified in a way his disgust and distress at being compelled to be here, but not enough to prevent him from feeling grim and sour. This was a dog's life, he thought. It was a tough thing to have come to. The one thought that strengthened him was the insult offered by Carrie. He was not down so low as to take all that, he thought. He could do something, this even, for a while. It would get better. He would save a little. A boy threw a clod of mud while he was thus reflecting and hit him upon the arm. It hurt sharply and angered him more than he had been any time since morning. "The little cur," he muttered. "Hurt you?" asked one of the policemen. "No," he answered. At one of the corners where the car slowed up because of a turn, an ex-motorman standing on the sidewalk called to him. "Won't you come out, partner, and be a man? Remember, we're fighting for decent day's wages, that's all. We've got families to support." The man seemed almost peaceably inclined. Hurstwood pretended not to see him. He kept his eyes straight on before and opened the lever wide. The voice had something appealing in it. All morning this went on, and long into the afternoon. He made three such trips. The dinner he had was no stay for such work, and the cold was telling on him. At each end of the line he stopped to thaw out, but he could have groaned at the anguish of it. One of the barnmen, out of pity, loaned him a heavy cap and a pair of sheepskin gloves, and for once he was extremely thankful. On the second trip of the afternoon, he ran into a crowd about halfway along the line that had blocked the car's progress with an old telegraph pole. "Get that thing off the track," yelled the two policemen. "Yeah, yeah, yeah," yelled the crowd. "Get it off yourself." The two policemen got down, and Hurstwood started to follow. "You stay there," one called. "Someone will run away with your car." Amid the babble of voices, Hurstwood heard one close beside him. "Come down, partner, and be a man. Don't fight the poor. Leave that to the corporations." He saw the same fellow who had called to him from the corner. Now, as before, he pretended not to hear him. "Come down," the man repeated gently. "You don't want to fight poor men. Don't fight at all." It was a most philosophic and Jesuitical motorman. A third policeman joined the other two from somewhere, and someone ran to telephone for more officers. Hurstwood gazed about, determined but fearful. A man grabbed him by the coat. "Come off of that," he exclaimed, jerking at him and trying to pull him over the railing. "Let go," said Hurstwood savagely. "I'll show you, you scab," cried a young Irishman, jumping up on the car and aiming a blow at Hurstwood. The latter ducked and caught it on the shoulder instead of the jaw. "Away from here," shouted an officer, hastening to the rescue and adding, of course, the usual oaths. Hurstwood recovered himself, pale and trembling. It was becoming serious with him now. People were looking up and jeering at him. One girl was making faces. He began to waver in his resolution when a patrol wagon rolled up and more officers dismounted. Now the track was quickly cleared and the release effected. "Let her go now, quick," said the officer, and again he was off. The end came with a real mob which met the car on its return trip a mile or two from the barns. It was an exceedingly poor-looking neighborhood. He wanted to run fast through it, but again the track was blocked. He saw men carrying something out to it when he was yet a half dozen blocks away. "There they are again," exclaimed one policeman. "I'll give them something this time," said the second officer, whose patience was becoming worn. Hurstwood suffered a qualm of body as the car rolled up. As before, a crowd began hooting, but now, rather than come near, they threw things. One or two windows were smashed, and Hurstwood dodged a stone. Both policemen ran out toward the crowd, but the latter replied by running toward the car. A woman, a mere girl in appearance, was among these, bearing a rough stick. She was exceedingly wrathful and struck at Hurstwood, who dodged. Thereupon, her companions, duly encouraged, jumped on the car and pulled Hurstwood over. He had hardly time to speak or shout before he fell.
"Let go of me," he said, falling on his side. "Ah, you sucker," he heard someone say. Kicks and blows rained on him. He seemed to be suffocating. Then two men seemed to be dragging him off, and he wrestled for freedom.
"Let up," said a voice. "You're all right. Stand up." He was let loose and recovered himself. Now he recognized two officers. He felt as if he would faint from exhaustion. Something was wet on his chin. He put up his hand and felt, then looked. It was red.
"They cut me," he said foolishly, fishing for his handkerchief.
"Now, now," said one of the officers. "It's only a scratch." His senses became cleared now, and he looked around. He was standing in a little store where they had left him for the moment. Outside he could see, as he stood wiping his chin, the car and the excited crowd. A patrol wagon was there, and another. He walked over and looked out. It was an ambulance, backing in. He saw some energetic charging by the police, and arrests being made.
"Come on now if you want to take your car," said an officer, opening the door and looking in.
He walked out, feeling rather uncertain of himself. He was very cold and frightened.
"Where's the conductor?" he asked.
"Oh, he's not here now," said the policeman. Hurstwood went toward the car and stepped nervously on. As he did so, there was a pistol shot. Something stung his shoulder.
"Who fired that?" he heard an officer exclaim. "By God, who did that?"
Both left him, running toward a certain building. He paused a moment, and then got down.
"George," exclaimed Hurstwood weakly, "this is too much for me."
He walked nervously to the corner and hurried down a side street.
"Phew," he said, drawing in his breath.
A half block away, a small girl gazed at him.
"You'd better sneak," she called.
He walked homeward in a blinding snowstorm, reaching the ferry by dusk. The cabins were filled with comfortable souls who studied him curiously. His head was in such a whirl that he felt confused. All the wonder of the twinkling lights of the river in a white storm passed for nothing. He trudged doggedly on until he reached the flat. There he entered and found the room warm. Carrie was gone. A couple of evening papers were lying on the table where she left them. He lit the gas and sat down. Then he got up and stripped to examine his shoulder. It was a mere scratch. He washed his hands and face, still in a brown study apparently, and combed his hair. Then he looked for something to eat, and finally, his hunger gone, sat down in his comfortable rocking chair. It was a wonderful relief. He put his hand to his chin, forgetting for the moment the papers.
"Well," he said after a time, his nature recovering itself, "that's a pretty tough game over there."
Then he turned and saw the papers. With a half sigh, he picked up the World. "Strike spreading in Brooklyn," he read. "Rioting breaks out in all parts of the city." He adjusted his paper very comfortably and continued. It was the one thing he read with absorbing interest.
"42. A Touch of Spring. The Empty Shell."
Those who look upon Hurstwood's Brooklyn venture as an error of judgment will nonetheless realize the negative influence on him of the fact that he had tried and failed. Carrie got the wrong idea of it. He said so little that she imagined he had encountered nothing worse than the ordinary roughness. Quitting so soon in the face of this seemed trifling. He did not want to work. She was now one of a group of Oriental beauties who, in the second act of the comic opera, were paraded by the vizier before the new potentate as the treasures of his harem. There was no word assigned to any of them, but on the evening when Hurstwood was housing himself in the loft of the streetcar barn, the leading comedian and star, feeling exceedingly facetious, said in a profound voice which created a ripple of laughter, "Well, who are you?"
It merely happened to be Carrie who was curtsying before him. It might as well have been any of the others, so far as he was concerned. He expected no answer, and a dull one would have been reproved. But Carrie, whose experience and belief in herself gave her daring, curtsied sweetly again and answered, "I am yours truly." It was a trivial thing to say, and yet something in the way she did it caught the audience, which laughed heartily at the mock fierce potentate towering before the young woman. The comedian also liked it, hearing the laughter. "I thought your name was Smith," he returned, endeavoring to get the last laugh. Carrie almost trembled for her daring after she had said this. All members of the company had been warned that to interpolate lines or business meant a fine or worse. She did not know what to think. As she was standing in her proper position in the wings, awaiting another entry, the great comedian made his exit past her and paused in recognition. "You can just leave that in hereafter," he remarked, seeing how intelligent she appeared. "Don't add any more, though." "Thank you," said Carrie humbly. When he went on, she found herself trembling violently. "Well, you're in luck," remarked another member of the chorus. "There isn't another one of us has got a line." There was no gainsaying the value of this. Everybody in the company realized that she had got a start. Carrie hugged herself when next evening the lines got the same applause. She went home rejoicing, knowing that soon something must come of it. It was Hurstwood who, by his presence, caused her merry thoughts to flee and replaced them with sharp longings for an end of distress. The next day she asked him about his venture. "They're not trying to run any cars except with police. They don't want anybody just now, not before next week." Next week came, but Carrie saw no change. Hurstwood seemed more apathetic than ever. He saw her off mornings to rehearsals and the like with the utmost calm. He read and read. Several times he found himself staring at an item but thinking of something else. The first of these lapses that he sharply noticed concerned a hilarious party he had once attended at a driving club of which he had been a member. He sat, gazing downward, and gradually thought he heard the old voices and the clink of glasses. "You're a dandy, Hurstwood," his friend Walker said. He was standing again, well-dressed, smiling, good-natured, the recipient of encores for a good story. All at once he looked up. The room was so still it seemed ghost-like. He heard the clock ticking audibly and half suspected that he had been dozing. The paper was so straight in his hands, however, and the items he had been reading so directly before him that he rid himself of the doze idea. Still, it seemed peculiar. When it occurred a second time, however, it did not seem quite so strange. Butcher and grocery man, baker and coal man, not the group with whom he was then dealing, but those who had trusted him to the limit, called. He met them all blandly, becoming deft in excuse. At last he became bold, pretended to be out, or waved them off. "They can't get blood out of a turnip," he said, "and if I had it, I'd pay them." Carrie's little soldier friend, Miss Osborne, seeing her succeeding, had become a sort of satellite. Little Osborne could never of herself amount to anything. She seemed to realize it in a sort of pussy-like way and instinctively concluded to cling with her soft little claws to Carrie. "Oh, you'll get up," she kept telling Carrie with admiration. "You're so good." Timid as Carrie was, she was strong in capability. The reliance of others made her feel as if she must, and when she must, she dared. Experience of the world and of necessity was in her favor. No longer the lightest word of a man made her head dizzy. She had learned that men could change and fail. Flattery in its most palpable form had lost its force with her. It required superiority, kindly superiority, to move her, the superiority of a genius like Ames. "I don't like the actors in our company," she told Lola one day.
They're all so struck on themselves.
Don't you think Mr. Barclay's pretty nice? Inquired Lola, who had received a condescending smile or two from that quarter.
Oh, he's nice enough, answered Carrie, but he isn't sincere. He assumes such an air.
Lola felt for her first hold upon Carrie in the following manner.
Are you paying room rent where you are?
Certainly, answered Carrie. Why?
I know where I could get the loveliest room and bath, cheap. It's too big for me, but it would be just right for two, and the rent is only $6 a week for both.
Where? Said Carrie.
In 17th Street.
Well, I don't know as I'd care to change, said Carrie, who was already turning over the $3 rate in her mind. She was thinking if she had only herself to support, this would leave her 17 for herself.
Nothing came of this until after the Brooklyn adventure of Hurstwood's and her success with the speaking part. Then she began to feel as if she must be free. She thought of leaving Hurstwood and thus making him act for himself, but he had developed such peculiar traits she feared he might resist any effort to throw him off. He might hunt her out at the show and hound her in that way. She did not wholly believe that he would, but he might. This, she knew, would be an embarrassing thing if he made himself conspicuous in any way. It troubled her greatly. Things were precipitated by the offer of a better part. One of the actresses playing the part of a modest sweetheart gave notice of leaving, and Carrie was selected.
"How much are you going to get?" asked Miss Osborne on hearing the good news.
"I didn't ask him," said Carrie.
"We'll find out. Goodness, you'll never get anything if you don't ask. Tell him you must have $40 anyhow."
"Oh, no," said Carrie.
"Certainly," exclaimed Lola. "Ask him anyway."
Carrie succumbed to this prompting, waiting, however, until the manager gave her notice of what clothing she must have to fit the part. "How much do I get?" she inquired.
$35, he replied.
Carrie was too much astonished and delighted to think of mentioning 40. She was nearly beside herself and almost hugged Lola, who clung to her at the news.
"It isn't as much as you ought to get," said the latter, "especially when you've got to buy clothes."
Carrie remembered this with a start. Where to get the money? She had none laid up for such an emergency. Rent day was drawing near. "I'll not do it," she said, remembering her necessity. "I don't use the flat. I'm not going to give up my money this time. I'll move." Fitting into this came another appeal from Miss Osborne, more urgent than ever.
"Come live with me, won't you?" she pleaded. "We can have the loveliest room. It won't cost you hardly anything that way."
"I'd like to," said Carrie frankly.
"Oh, do," said Lola. "We'll have such a good time."
Carrie thought a while. "I believe I will," she said, and then added, "I'll have to see first, though." With the idea thus grounded, rent day approaching, and clothes calling for instant purchase, she soon found excuse in Hurstwood's lassitude. He said less and drooped more than ever. As rent day approached, an idea grew in him. It was fostered by the demands of creditors and the impossibility of holding up many more. $28 was too much for rent. "It's hard on her," he thought. "We could get a cheaper place." Stirred with this idea, he spoke at the breakfast table.
"Don't you think we pay too much rent here?" he asked.
"Indeed I do," said Carrie, not catching his drift.
"I should think we could get a smaller place," he suggested. "We don't need four rooms."
Her countenance, had he been scrutinizing her, would have exhibited the disturbance she felt at this evidence of his determination to stay by her. He saw nothing remarkable in asking her to come down lower.
"Oh, I don't know," she answered, growing wary. "There must be places around here where we could get a couple of rooms, which would do just as well."
Her heart revolted.
"Never," she thought.
Who would furnish the money to move? To think of being in two rooms with him. She resolved to spend her money for clothes quickly before something terrible happened. That very day she did it. Having done so, there was but one other thing to do. Lola, she said, visiting her friend, I think I'll come.
Oh, jolly, cried the latter.
Can we get it right away? She asked, meaning the room.
Certainly, cried Lola.
They went to look at it. Carrie had saved $10 from her expenditures, enough for this and her board beside. Her enlarged salary would not begin for 10 days yet, would not reach her for 17. She paid half of the $6 with her friend. Now I've just enough to get on to the end of the week, she confided.
Oh, I've got some, said Lola. I've got $25 if you need it.
No, said Carrie. I guess I'll get along. They decided to move Friday, which was 2 days away. Now that the thing was settled, Carrie's heart misgave her. She felt very much like a criminal in the matter. Each day, looking at Hurstwood, she had realized that, along with the disagreeableness of his attitude, there was something pathetic. She looked at him the same evening she had made up her mind to go, and now he seemed not so shiftless and worthless, but run down and beaten upon by chance. His eyes were not keen, his face marked, his hands flabby. She thought his hair had a touch of gray. All unconscious of his doom, he rocked and read his paper while she glanced at him. Knowing that the end was so near, she became rather solicitous. "Will you go over and get some canned peaches?" she asked Hurstwood, laying down a $2 bill. "Certainly," he said, looking in wonder at the money. "See if you can get some nice asparagus," she added. "I'll cook it for dinner." Hurstwood rose and took the money, slipping on his overcoat and getting his hat. Carrie noticed that both of these articles of apparel were old and poor-looking in appearance. It was plain enough before, but now it came home with peculiar force. Perhaps he couldn't help it after all. He had done well in Chicago. She remembered his fine appearance the days he had met her in the park. Then he was so sprightly, so clean. Had it been all his fault? He came back and laid the change down with the food. You'd better keep it, she observed. We'll need other things. No, he said with a sort of pride. You keep it. Oh, go on and keep it, she replied, rather unnerved. There'll be other things. He wondered at this, not knowing the pathetic figure he had become in her eyes. She restrained herself with difficulty from showing a quaver in her voice. To say truly, this would have been Carrie's attitude in any case. She had looked back at times upon her parting from Drouet, and had regretted that she had served him so badly. She hoped she would never meet him again, but she was ashamed of her conduct. Not that she had any choice in the final separation. She had gone willingly to seek him, with sympathy in her heart, when Hurstwood had reported him ill. There was something cruel somewhere, and not being able to track it mentally to its logical lair, she concluded with feeling that he would never understand what Hurstwood had done, and would see hard-hearted decision in her deed. Hence her shame. Not that she cared for him. She did not want to make anyone who had been good to her feel badly. She began to realize what she was doing by allowing these feelings to possess her. Hurstwood, noticing the kindness, conceived better of her. Carrie's good-natured, anyhow, he thought. Going to Miss Osborne's that afternoon, she found that little lady packing and singing.
Why don't you come over with me today? She asked.
Oh, I can't, said Carrie. I'll be there Friday. Would you mind lending me the $25 you spoke of?
Why, no, said Lola, going for her purse.
I want to get some other things, said Carrie.
Oh, that's all right, answered the little girl good-naturedly, glad to be of service.
It had been days since Hurstwood had done more than go to the grocery store or to the newsstand. Now the weariness of indoors was upon him, had been for 2 days, but chill gray weather had held him back.
Friday broke fair and warm. It was one of those lovely harbingers of spring, given as a sign in dreary winter that earth is not forsaken of warmth and beauty. The blue heaven, holding its one golden orb, poured down a crystal wash of warm light. It was plain from the voice of the sparrows that all was halcyon outside. Carrie raised the front windows and felt the south wind blowing. "It's lovely out today," she remarked.
"Is it?" said Hurstwood.
After breakfast, he immediately got his other clothes. "Will you be back for lunch?" asked Carrie nervously.
"No," he said.
He went out into the streets and tramped north along 7th Avenue, idly fixing upon the Harlem River as an objective point. He had seen some ships up there the time he had called upon the Brewers. He wondered how the territory thereabouts was growing. Passing 59th Street, he took the west side of Central Park, which he followed to 78th Street. Then he remembered the neighborhood and turned over to look at the mass of buildings erected. It was very much improved. The great open spaces were filling up. Coming back, he kept to the park until 110th Street, and then turned into 7th Avenue again, reaching the pretty river by 1 o'clock. There it ran, winding before his gaze, shining brightly in the clear light between the undulating banks on the right and the tall, tree-covered heights on the left. The spring-like atmosphere woke him to a sense of its loveliness, and for a few moments he stood looking at it, folding his hands behind his back. Then he turned and followed it toward the east side, idly seeking the ships he had seen. It was 4 o'clock before the waning day, with its suggestion of a cooler evening, caused him to return. He was hungry and would enjoy eating in a warm room. When he reached the flat by 5:30, it was still dark. He knew that Carrie was not there, not only because there was no light showing through the transom, but because the evening papers were stuck between the outside knob and the door. He opened with his key and went in. Everything was still dark. Lighting the gas, he sat down, preparing to wait a little while. Even if Carrie did come now, dinner would be late. He read until 6, then got up to fix something for himself. As he did so, he noticed that the room seemed a little queer. What was it? He looked around, as if he missed something, and then saw an envelope near where he had been sitting. It spoke for itself, almost without further action on his part. Reaching over, he took it, a sort of chill settling upon him even while he reached. The crackle of the envelope in his hands was loud. Green paper money lay soft within the note. "Dear George," he read, crunching the money in one hand, "I'm going away. I'm not coming back anymore. It's no use trying to keep up the flat. I can't do it. I wouldn't mind helping you if I could, but I can't support us both and pay the rent. I need what little I make to pay for my clothes. I'm leaving $20. It's all I have just now. You can do whatever you like with the furniture. I don't want it. Carrie." He dropped the note and looked quietly round. Now he knew what he missed. It was the little ornamental clock which was hers. It was gone from the mantelpiece. He went into the front room, his bedroom, the parlor, lighting the gas as he went. From the chiffonier had gone the knick-knacks of silver and plate. From the tabletop, the lace coverings. He opened the wardrobe. No clothes of hers. He opened the drawers. Nothing of hers. Her trunk was gone from its accustomed place. Back in his own room hung his old clothes, just as he had left them. Nothing else was gone. He stepped into the parlor and stood for a few moments, looking vacantly at the floor. The silence grew oppressive. The little flat seemed wonderfully deserted. He wholly forgot that he was hungry, that it was only dinner time. It seemed later in the night. Suddenly he found that the money was still in his hands. There were $20 in all, as she had said. Now he walked back, leaving the lights ablaze and feeling as if the flat were empty. "I'll get out of this," he said to himself. Then the sheer loneliness of his situation rushed upon him in full. "Left me," he muttered and repeated.
left me. The place that had been so comfortable, where he had spent so many days of warmth, was now a memory. Something colder and chillier confronted him. He sank down in his chair, resting his chin in his hand, mere sensation without thought holding him. Then something like a bereaved affection and self-pity swept over him. "She needn't have gone away," he said. "I'd have got something." He sat a long while without rocking, and added quite clearly, out loud, "I tried, didn't I?" At midnight, he was still rocking, staring at the floor. "43. The world turns flatterer. An eye in the dark." Installed in her comfortable room, Carrie wondered how Hurstwood had taken her departure. She arranged a few things hastily and then left for the theater, half expecting to encounter him at the door. Not finding him, her dread lifted, and she felt more kindly toward him. She quite forgot him until about to come out after the show, when the chance of his being there frightened her. As day after day passed and she heard nothing at all, the thought of being bothered by him passed. In a little while she was, except for occasional thoughts, wholly free of the gloom with which her life had been weighed in the flat. It is curious to note how quickly a profession absorbs one. Carrie became wise in theatrical lore, hearing the gossip of little Lola. She learned what the theatrical papers were, which ones published items about actresses and the like. She began to read the newspaper notices, not only of the opera in which she had so small a part, but of others. Gradually,